These were Hippotas' home waters, and he knew them intimately. At times, he skirted the reefs and the headlands so closely that it seemed I could step ashore from the deck without wetting my feet. I gazed across at the passing landscape with fascination. I had not expected it to be so mountainous, nor to be so lushly forested. I have spent so much of my life in the dry desert places that for me it was exotic and beautiful. It was past noon when we rounded the most easterly point of the island and changed course to head back along the northern shore towards Knossos. The angle of the sunlight was so altered that the water under our keel was transmuted to a wondrous shade of blue. The sea ahead of us was dotted with shipping, from tiny anchored fishing boats to the great trading triremes with their churning banks of long oars and their clouds of vivid sails. As we passed the mouths of the bays and harbours which indented the shoreline, I saw that these were also crowded with anchored ships, taking on or discharging cargo. The cargoes they carried were the sinews of trade which generated the wealth that had transformed this small island into a colossus towering over the civilized world. And yet I knew from my studies that the land itself was rocky and rugged. The soil was poor, devoid of precious minerals and unsuited to cultivation. Although the great forests grew upon it in profusion, their roots suffered a further barrier to the rearing of valuable crops. The Minoans had solved this problem by sending out their ships across the seas to gather up the raw materials produced by other lands. Paying a pittance for these riches, they transported them back to Crete. Here, by the application of their engineering skills and their genius for design and innovation, they transformed them into highly desirable products for which the rest of the world hungered. They refined the ore, which other more primitive peoples had scratched from the earth with sharpened sticks, and they fashioned these metals into swords and knives, helmets and armor for warriors, and hoes and pitchforks and plowshares for farmers. They had perfected the firing of silica sands and other minerals to make glass, an extraordinary substance which they fashioned into plates and dishes and utensils that graced the banquet tables of kings, ornaments and jewelry of myriad colors to delight the wives of rich men, and beads which some tribes used as currency. There were some primitive countries in which a string of these glass beads could buy a thoroughbred horse or a beautiful young virgin. The Minoans traded these products for the hemp and cotton, linen and wool that subsistence farmers in other lands had grown. They worked and wove these into cloth and canvas for garments and tents and ships' sails. These in turn they sent out to trade, repeating the cycle endlessly, until no other nation could match their wealth, not even our very Egypt. There was a hidden cost to this ceaseless and single-minded pursuit of riches. From my vantage point in the rigging of the sacred bull, I looked out across the land, and I saw the smoke rising from the myriad forges and furnaces in which the ores were refined, the metals alloyed, and the sands transmuted to glass. On the mountainsides above the towns and factories were wide areas of desolation, the scarred earth where the forests had been put to the axe to provide the timber for the hulls of the Minoan trading ships, or to be burned into charcoal for the furnaces in their mills. I saw the inshore waters stained and corrupted by the poisonous dyes and corrosive fluids they used in their mills, and which they drained directly into the sea. As much as any man alive, I enjoy the weight and luster of silver and gold in my hands, but faced with this defloration of pristine nature, I wondered at the ultimate price that man is prepared to pay to feed his insatiable greed. My musings were interrupted by a hail from below, and I peered down and saw Ambassador Toran had returned to the deck and was beckoning me to come down to join him. When I reached the side, he was apologetic. "I cannot remain too long aloft," he explained. "I find the ship's gyrations to be unpleasantly exaggerated by the height of the mast, and I would not care to part with the excellent breakfast my chef went to such pains to prepare for me." He took my arm and led me forward. "The view from the bows will be just as good as from the masthead, and I wanted to be able to point out the sights of interest as we clear Dragonada Island and have a full view of Knossos and Mount Cronus. We settled ourselves comfortably in the shade of the foresail, while the ship tacked around the point of the island, and a fresh vista of the northern coast of Crete was spread out before us. On our port side, we had a marvellous view of Mount Ida, which was the complete reverse of that which we had enjoyed from the southern side of the island. From this angle, the mountain seemed to be even higher, steeper, and more rugged. Below it, the city of Knossos and its harbour lay open to us. The harbour was vast, but its waters seemed barely expansive enough to accommodate the fleet of Minoan war galleys and cargo ships which lay at anchor within. Some of these vessels were large enough to dwarf the sacred bull, on whose deck we reclined. Above the harbour rose the buildings of the city. I realized at once that it was many times larger in extent than Thebes and Babylon combined. However, compared to Knossos, those two smaller cities were pretty, gay, and welcoming. Despite its backdrop of high and majestic mountains and the scope of the grandeur of its architecture, Knossos was a sombre and dark-toned place. My senses are so finely tuned to the subtle undercurrents and hidden nuances of the preternatural that I knew at once that Knossos had been built upon one of those rare fields of power on which the gods have focused all their energies. In this enlightened age, it is accepted by educated men that the earth is a living and breathing creature, a gigantic turtle, which swims forever on the black ocean of eternity. The plates that form the carapace that cover the turtle's back are fused along these lines of power. When the earth moves, these junctions enable it to flex its body and limbs. These are centres of unimaginable force, some for good, but others for evil. Here was evil. I had the rank taste of it on the back of my tongue and the stench of it in my nostrils. I shuddered as I tried to come to terms with the enormity of it. "Are you cold, Taita?" Torin asked solicitously. Although I shook my head and smiled, I did not trust my face not to reveal my true feelings. I turned away from him and looked directly out to sea. Far from calming my forebodings, I found them further agitated by my first close-up view of the twin peaks of Mount Cronus. My perturbation must have been obvious to him, for Torren chuckled and patted my shoulder in an avuncular manner. "Be of good cheer, Taita. Most people experience the same reaction as you when first they look upon the citadel of Cronus, the father of all the gods. Do you know the history of this place, and the story of how all these mysteries came to pass?" "I know little or nothing about it." In truth, I was sure that I knew it all much better than Torren himself. But often it is best to plead ignorance. That way you are more likely to learn secrets that might otherwise have been denied you. Torren took up my instruction with relish. "As a man of letters and learning, you must agree that Cronos is the father of all the gods. Before him, there is only Gaia, the earth, and Uranus, the sky. When those two mated, Cronus was born of their union." "That much I do know," I conceded carefully. I would not be drawn into an argument, although I knew there were other more plausible explanations of creation. "But please continue, good Torren." "In time, Cronos warred against his father Uranus and defeated him. Then he castrated him and made him slave. Cronos ruled throughout the golden age of the gods. However, he was aware of the prophecy that one of his children would war against him, as he had done with his own father. So he devoured all his own children at birth to prevent this happening. In the circumstances, eating them was probably a reasonable option. I know of more than one mortal father who wished he had adopted that expedient," I bantered with a straight face. But Torren took me seriously and nodded, "Quite so." "However, to continue, when Rhea, who was Cronos' senior wife, gave birth to her sixth child, she named the boy Zeus and hid him from his father in a cave up there on Mount Ida." He pointed across the bay at the mountain. Thus Zeus survived to maturity. Then, as he prophesied, he battled with Cronus. When he defeated him, he sliced open his father's belly, and all his siblings leapt out to freedom. Then Zeus and his brothers and sisters flew to the peak of Mount Olympus, where they abide to this day, ruling our lives with a high hand. I moved the lecture along at an accelerated pace. At times, Tauran can be a pedant. His siblings are Hestia, the goddess of home and the hearth, Demeter, the goddess of agriculture and bountiful harvest, Hera, the goddess of marriage, Hades, the lord of the underworld, and Poseidon, the god of the sea. You said that you were ignorant of their history. Tauran looked mildly aggrieved, but then he hurried on before I could relate the rest of the story. Zeus was able to kill his father by reason of his immortality, so before Zeus departed for Olympus, he imprisoned Cronus in the fiery depths of that volcano, which now bears his name. Both of us studied the mountain in silence for a while. It is the oldest and most powerful volcano in the world. Tauran broke the silence. All its power is controlled by Cronus. With it, he protects us from the envy of foreign kings and the avarice of less civilized nations. In merely one instance, when the Euboeans sent their fleet to attack us, Cronus hurled great fiery rocks against them from the heights of his mountain, sinking most of their ships and driving the survivors back whence they had come. I stared across at the mountain. It was indeed a forbidding sight. There was no evidence of plant or animal life of any kind on the steep, pyramid-shaped ramparts. They fell almost sheer to the water's edge, shining black and glossy red sheets of solidified vitreous lava flow. From the twin apertures that pierced the summits of the peaks, the molten lava still oozed and trickled down, glowing and shimmering with heat, rivers of fire that exploded in clouds of steam when they met the sea that lapped the base of the mountain. When Cronus is either very pleased or extremely angry, he blows out smoke and fire, Tauran explained. The intensity of his anger or pleasure can be judged by the volume and force of his fiery breath. You can see from his gentle exhalations that at present he is sleeping or in a jovial mood. When he is truly aroused, he blows out molten rocks and clouds of sulphurous smoke that spurt so high into the sky that they mingle with the clouds. Then his bellowing can be heard in every part of Crete, and his violent shuddering and shaking felt in distant lands, far across the sea. What might make him that angry? I asked Tauran. He is the mightiest of all the gods. Cronus does not need a reason to be angry, and he certainly is not accountable to us for his whims and fancies. He is angry because he is angry. It's as simple as that. I nodded wisely as I listened to Tauran extolling the powers and justifying the excesses of his particular god. Of course, I did not agree with him. I have studied the history and origin of all the gods. There are hundreds of them. Like the mortals and the demigods, they differ vastly in their power and temperament, and in their virtue and their iniquity. What puzzled me was that a superior man such as Tauran should pay such homage and allegiance to a raging monster in preference to a noble and benevolent deity like Horus. I trust neither Cronus nor Seth. What is more, I have never been entirely certain of Zeus. How can I trust someone, even a god, who delights in playing shabby tricks on mankind and on his own immediate family? No, I am a Horus man, through and through. The congestion of shipping in and around the port of Knossos was so great that as we approached, the harbour master sent out a lugger with a message denying the sacred bull immediate entry, and ordering us to anchor in the roadstead until a berth could be found for us in the inner harbour. Ambassador Tauran went ashore in the harbour master's lugger to inform the palace of our arrival. Within an hour of Tauran's departure, a cutter came out to our anchorage. He flew the royal ensign of Crete. On the face was the golden bull and on the reverse the double-bladed executioner's axe, signifying the powers of life and death wielded by the supreme Minos. I had been warned by Tauran before he went ashore that Tahuti and Bekatha, as future royal brides, should be confined to their cabins away from masculine eyes. When they did appear in public, their faces must be heavily veiled, and even their hands and feet had to be completely covered until they were securely lodged in the royal seraglio. When I told them of the Minoan dress code, the girls were outraged. They were accustomed to going stark naked when they felt that way inclined. It had taken all my tact and bargaining skills to convince them to pander to Minoan manners and mores, and to behave like members of the Minoan royal family. With these strictures very much in mind, I was the only non-Minoan on the poop deck of the Sacred Bull to greet these deputations from the palace. Standing in the bows of the approaching cutter with Ambassador Toran were three palace officials. One of these bespoke us as soon as they were within hailing distance. "In the name of the Supreme Minos," he demanded permission to come on board, a request which Captain Hippitos granted with alacrity. These three visitors were dressed in full-length black robes, the hems of which swept the deck as they walked down the deck towards me with their deliberate and stately tread. They wore tall, brimless hats, which were draped with black ribbons. Their beards were dyed soot-black and had even been tightly curled with hot tongs. Their faces were powdered with white chalk, but their eyes were circled with kohl. The contrast was startling. Their expressions were lugubrious. Ambassador Toran followed them closely and introduced them to me as they stopped before me. I bowed to each of them in turn as Toran recited their multiple names and elaborate titles. "Lord Tahita, the senior emissary," returned my bow. "I am ordered by the Supreme Minos to welcome you to the Kingdom of Crete." He went on to assure me that our arrival had been keenly anticipated. However, there had been uncertainty in the palace as to the exact time and date of that happy event. Now they required a further 24 hours to prepare a fitting welcome for the royal Egyptian ladies who were betrothed to the Supreme Minos. "A state barge will come out to this ship at noon tomorrow. It will convey you and the royal brides to the palace, where the Supreme Minos will be waiting to welcome them into his family." "Your Supreme Minos is extremely gracious," I acknowledged. What was, in essence, a diplomatically worded royal command rather than an invitation. "His Majesty has commanded me to assure the royal ladies of his pleasure at their arrival. He has further asked me to present them with these tokens of his royal favour." He indicated the heavy silver caskets being carried by the black-attired aides that flanked him. They set the gifts down on the deck and then backed away from me with deep bows. The meeting was at an end. They returned to the cutter which had brought them. I was learning that the Minoans were a serious people who wasted little time in either ceremony or polite formalities. Ambassador Toran went ashore with them. At least he gave me a brief smile and a discreet wave as he boarded the cutter. I hoped that the gifts the Supreme Minos had sent might lighten the gloom of my princesses. Indeed, they proved worthy of the richest monarch in our world. The gold and silver glimmered, and the precious stones lit the cabin with rays of multicoloured light. Tahuti and Bekatha examined them listlessly before discarding them and returning to their melancholia. Up until now, I had put in place stern strictures that ensured that neither of my girls had ever enjoyed the solace of the grape, but I recognized that the time had come when dire affliction called for strong remedy. I went down to the ship's hold and broached one of Ambassador Toran's amphorae. I half-filled three large copper flagons with the luscious red Cyclades wine. Then I topped them up with water and had the ship's steward carry them up to the cabin in which my girls were languishing. "You want us to drink that poison?" Tahuti demanded. "But you told us that it would make us go bald." "It will do so only if you drink it when you are very young. But now you are all grown up," I explained. "Look at me. Am I bald?" Reluctantly they conceded that I was not. "You also told us it would make our teeth fall out," Bekatha reminded me. In rebuttal, I snapped my own perfect set of teeth at her. They considered that in silence for a while. "It will make you feel more cheerful and happy," I wheedled. "I don't want to feel cheerful and happy," Becca spoke firmly. "I just want to die."
"At least you will die happy," I reasoned.
"Perhaps we should make Loxias try it first." Tehuti regarded the Minoan girl thoughtfully. Becca pushed one of the flagons across the table to her. Loxias sighed with resignation. She had long grown accustomed to being assigned the least pleasant and potentially hazardous tasks. She raised the cup to her lips and took a tiny sip. Then she straightened up, holding the wine in her mouth.
"Swallow it," Tehuti ordered her.
She obeyed, and they watched her carefully, waiting to see if she would shed her hair or her teeth. Loxias smiled.
"It tastes good."
She bowed her head over the flagon again.
"That's enough. You don't have to drink it all,"
Tehuti protested, and took the flagon out of her hands. They passed it around their circle, discussing the taste with animation. Becca thought it tasted like plums, but Tehuti said that it was definitely ripe pomegranate. Loxias offered no opinion, but set about making certain she was not denied her fair share. She was the first one to laugh. The other two stared at her with surprise. Then Becca giggled. Within the hour, the three of them had shed all their clothing and decked themselves with the resplendent jewellery that the Supreme Minos had sent them. I was playing one of their favourite dance tunes on my lyre, and they were cavorting around the cabin, shrieking with laughter. It was after midnight, before Becca finally collapsed on her bunk. But the other two were not far behind her. I covered them with the bedsheets, kissed each one of them goodnight, and blew out the lamp. I climbed the companionway to the main deck to savour the night air, feeling well enough pleased with myself. My princesses were dressed in Minoan style and waiting on the main deck when the royal barge emerged from the harbour at noon the following day and rowed towards the sacred bull. Until they moved, there was nothing to suggest that there was a living creature beneath the layers of black cloth and veils that covered them. Ambassador Toran had sent these costumes and accessories across to us in another vessel earlier that morning. It had taken all my guile and ingenuity to induce the girls to don these outlandish costumes. Loxias had been spared the indignity. Although her dress was long and black, and her hat was also tall, conical, and decked with black ribbons, her face and hands at least were uncovered. She was merely a serving wench, and had she gone bare-breasted, I'm sure nobody would have remarked the fact. I led them down into the barge to the solemn beat of the drums, played by four of the priests from the Temple of Cronus, who sat in the stern. Then we were rowed into the inner harbour of the port, and I had the opportunity to study more closely the towering edifices that surrounded the basin and crowded down to the edge of the water. These were built in their entirety from blocks of dun-grey stone, which I later learned were quarried in the mountains. There was little to distinguish any one of these buildings from its neighbours. They were all massively ugly. The roofs were flat. The windows were narrow slits that were covered with opaque grey glass. The largest building stood directly across from the harbour entrance. It did not need the statue of the Golden Bull of Crete on its rooftop to indicate to us that this was one of the four great palaces of the Supreme Minos. With practiced precision, the oarsmen brought the barge to rest against the quay in front of the palace, where a phalanx of dignitaries waited to welcome my small party ashore. Every one of them wore the identical full-length black uniforms and the tall conical hats. All their faces were white with chalk, and their eyes were outlined with coal. A few of them wore gold and silver chains and other decorations over their coats, denoting their superior rank and status. Even I was dressed in the full-length black robes which Ambassador Toran had sent out to me. But I wore my magnificent gold helmet, with its feathered crest, and my face was devoid of chalk or coal. The only persons in the entire assembly who were not wearing solid black were the four lithe and very dark-skinned warriors in bright green tunics with leather cross-straps over their upper bodies and leather helmets covering their heads, who came forward smartly to meet my princesses as they stepped ashore. They were armed with short swords and daggers. Two of them carried whips, which I hoped were ceremonial rather than functional. They took up positions on each side of my girls. There was something strangely feminine about these green-clad bodyguards. Their faces were beardless and smooth, their features were delicate and finely chiselled, as were their hands. They lacked only the protuberances of feminine breasts. They were as flat-chested as any boy. I decided they were some form of hermaphrodite. Just another peculiarity among so many I had already encountered in this peculiar land. I put them out of my mind and followed my girls through the doorway into the cavernous vestibule of the palace. This was crowded shoulder to shoulder with black-clad, chalky-faced multitudes. However, I saw not a single woman in the entire assembly. We Egyptians are proud of our women, and we expect them to play a major and highly visible role in the life of our nation. I found this gender-motivated isolationism unnatural and repugnant. An open lane had been left down the centre of the marble-paved floor, just wide enough for my girls and their green-uniformed escorts to pass along it. It ran straight to another set of doors at the far side of the hall. Our little party started down this lane, but I had not covered more than a dozen paces before somebody stepped out of the crowd and fell in beside me. For a moment I did not realize that it was Ambassador Toran, because he was also clad entirely in black, and his face was deathly white with cadaverous black eye sockets. But he wore a gold chain that I recognized, and even though he spoke in sepulchral tones, his voice was unmistakable. "Everything is going precisely as planned. The Supreme Minos and his entire council are waiting for us in the throne room beyond those doors ahead," he indicated them with a thrust of his chin. "Even the Queen Mother is with him. That is a rare honour. You will not be expected to take any part in today's proceedings, but from tomorrow onwards you will be working closely with the Lord High Admiral and his war council, planning the campaign against the Hyksos." "I am relieved and delighted to hear you say that." Even though I kept my voice as low as his, it was the truth. It had taken me years of intense planning, and even more intense endeavour, to reach this point. We were standing on the threshold of success. "However, when will the marriage ceremony take place?" I asked. Toran shot me a startled glance through his coal-ringed eyes, but before he could reply, the polished cedarwood doors, with their golden bull decorations, swung soundlessly open ahead of us. To the solemn beat of a single hidden drummer, we paced into the throne room, and paused while the doors closed silently behind us. The interior was so dimly lit. There were no lamps. The few narrow window slits were covered by dark-coloured woolen curtains. The ceiling was so high that it merged into the shadows. However, my eyes adjusted swiftly to their normal acuity, so the details of shapes and figures emerged from the gloom. In the centre of the room was the throne set on a raised podium. A tight knot of men were gathered around the base of the throne. To the left of the throne were gathered the priests of Cronus. They wore long capes and cowls that obscured their features. These garments were a deep russet colour, which I learned later from Toran was known as bull's blood red. On the opposite side of the throne stood another group of courtiers and nobles. Some of these were wearing the traditional long black robes and high hat. Facing them were the high-ranking military and naval commanders. Their uniforms were as gaudy and colourful as the dress of the nobles was drab. The throne itself was massive. It was carved from ebony and inlaid with mother-of-pearl. Even though the seat was wide enough to accommodate five large men in armour, there were only two figures occupying it at present. One of these was the only woman in the throne room, apart from my princesses and Loxias. I stared at her in incredulity. She was the most ancient woman I have ever laid eyes upon. She seemed as old as time itself. Her scrawny body and limbs were covered with dusty black lace, but her hands were gloveless. Her fingers were twisted into grotesque shapes with arthritis and age. The backs of her skeletal hands were knotted with bunched blue veins. Her face was yellow and creased like the skin of a windfall apple, which had lain at the foot of the tree for a season in the sun. It no longer seemed human. The sparse and greasy strings of her hair were dyed bright red and plastered to her skull or curled around her ears. Her eyes were sunk in their deep sockets. One eye was black and shiny as polished obsidian. The other was opaque and dribbled tears down her withered cheek. The tears dripped onto the black lace that covered her upper body. In the silence, she hawked and coughed up a lump of green and yellow mucus. When she opened her mouth to spit it on the marble tiles, I saw that her teeth were black and ragged as the burned-out stumps of the forest after a fire has swept through it. "Pasiphae, the Queen Mother," Toran whispered so softly that only I could hear him. Beside her towered a gigantic hominoid shape, clad in a robe of silver filigree and a breastplate of embossed gold. However, the creature seemed too large to be human. Was it some preternatural beast or being from the Minoan pantheon of the immortals, I wondered. Its hands were covered by gloves made from furry black skin, which I surmised was wild buffalo. Its lower limbs were covered by high boots of the same material. The most astonishing feature was the creature's head. It was completely enclosed by a mask of precious metals. This was fashioned in the shape of a wild aurochs bull's head, with flaring nostrils and a shaggy mane. The massive horns set in the mask were authentic, taken from the carcass of the same animal. They were long, forward-curved, and murderously pointed. I had seen almost identical specimens among the hunting trophies of King Nimrod in Babylon. The eye-holes in the mask seemed to be black and empty until I moved slightly to one side. The masked head turned to follow my movement, and in doing so, altered the angle of the light from the high windows. I could make out the glint and flickering movement of living eyes deep in the sockets. Were they human, bestial, or divine? There was no way of knowing. The hidden drummer gave a double beat and then fell silent. Nothing and nobody moved in the sudden quiet. Then the masked figure on the throne rose to its feet and spread its arms. It let out a bellow like a wild bull, with the smell of oestrus in its nostrils. The sound echoed within the creature's head mask with such intensity that I realized the Minoan engineers must have devised some means of amplifying it to this extraordinary volume. In unison, the entire congregation, including the priests, emitted a groan of veneration so deep and intense that it sounded like terror. And then they prostrated themselves. The green-clad guards on each side of my girls forced them face down on the marbled floor. Ambassador Toran seized my wrist and pulled me down with him. "Lie still," he hissed at me, "on your life. Don't look up." I obeyed him. I had no inkling what was taking place, but I knew that this was no time to argue or object. I lay still, groaning only when the rest of the congregation groaned, knocking my forehead on the paving only when everyone else did so. The tirade from the throne continued unabated, if anything increasing in volume, until my head began to throb. Although I had studied the Minoan language so devotedly, I understood not a word of what the Supreme Minos was saying. Either he was haranguing us in an arcane tongue, or the amplification had distorted his words beyond my ability to recognize them. I have a bracelet which I wear on my right wrist on occasions such as this. On a light chain is suspended a small golden disc, which I have polished to mirror-like perfection. In the reflection I am able to watch anything or anybody, in front or behind me, without moving or lifting my head.
In this way, I have learned many interesting things, and more than once I have avoided death by the same means. Suddenly, in my little mirror, I saw a circular black curtain drop, silently, from amongst the shadows of the ceiling. It was exactly the size of the podium on which the throne stood. It completely encircled and enshrouded both the supreme Minos and Pasiphae, his mother. Then it was drawn up again as swiftly as it had descended, and both the throne and the podium were left empty. The supreme Minos and his mother had disappeared. It was as neat a stroke of stagecraft as I have ever witnessed. The hidden drummer began to beat again. At this signal, all of us came to our knees and raised our heads. There was a murmur of awe and cries of amazement when we realized that the supreme Minos and his mother had disappeared. I joined in without needing to be encouraged by Toran. After having fully expressed my astonishment at the miraculous powers of the King of Crete, I rose to my feet beside Toran and asked, "I presume that the supreme Minos has set a time and date for the marriage ceremony. Am I correct?" "Please forgive me, Lord Taita. I should have explained more fully. I assumed that you understood what was happening." He looked truly abashed. "That was the marriage ceremony we have just witnessed." I could not remember when last I had been at a loss for anything intelligent or witty to say. But at last I rallied, although I could hear my voice croak as I spoke. "I don't understand, Toran. I asked about the wedding of my Egyptian princesses." "That was the wedding. They are no longer princesses. They are now Minoan queens. You and I have accomplished what we set out to achieve." He took my arm as though to steady me. I shook off his hand, still staring at him. "What happens to my girls now?" I insisted. "The viragos will take them to the royal seraglio." He indicated the green-uniformed bodyguards with an inclination of his head. "I'm not yet ready to accompany them," I protested. "First I must pick up my possessions from the sacred bull." "Men are never allowed in the palace of the royal wives. I'm really very sorry, my lord." "You know full well that I am not a man entire, Toran. I have never been forcibly separated from my girls." "In terms of Minoan law, you are a man," he avowed. "What about these other creatures?" I demanded, as I indicated the green-uniformed guards who were lifting my princesses to their feet. "Aren't they men? Even more than I am, Toran." "No, Taita. They are women of the Umbalala tribe of Western Africa." "But they have no breasts," I protested. "Those were amputated at puberty, so that they are able to wield the sword more skillfully. But down below they are fully women. I shall give you proof of that." He turned to the captain of the viragos and spoke sharply. Obediently, she lifted the skirt of her green tunic and displayed her perfect cunny. "You may touch it if you wish, master, but only if you are willing to sacrifice your arm for the privilege." With her hand on the hilt of her sword, the virago smiled, challenging me to make the attempt. I shook my head and turned back to Toran. "When will I be able to see my girls again?" I heard the pleading tone in my own voice. "I hate to be the one who must answer that question for you, because the answer is never." Toran spoke with finality. "No man, other than the supreme Minos, will see their faces again until the day they die." Looking back on it later with the wisdom of hindsight, I realized the last part of his statement was intended as a covert warning. But I was so distraught in the face of my impending loss that it was lost on me. The four viragos lifted my veiled princesses to their feet and led them away. Loxias followed them, but she glanced back at me and whispered too softly for me to hear, although I read her lips, "I will guard them with my own life." I could no longer restrain myself, and I started forward to prevent this thing happening. But Toran seized my arm and held me. "You are unarmed, Taita. Those viragos are trained killers. They know not mercy." I stood and watched them go. I could see that Becketha was weeping. Under the veils, her whole body was shaking. In contrast, Tehuti stepped out into the unknown, like a heroine. In the wall behind the ebony throne, a door opened silently. With an aching despair, I watched them disappear through it. It was as though my life had ended. They were gone from me forever. Those two, who for many years had been my main reason for existing. Ambassador Torren knew how deeply I was attached to my charges, and how bitterly I had been wounded by my loss. He proved now that he had become my true friend. He took it upon himself to shepherd me through the weird complexities of Minoan society. He had a carriage waiting for us in the courtyard behind the palace. In it we were driven up the winding road to the large mansion set on the mountainside above the city of Knossos. This was to be the Egyptian embassy, with me as its ambassador. As we climbed, Torren chatted to me lightly to distract me, pointing out the salient features of the city spread below us. These included the naval headquarters and the spreading complex of government buildings by means of which the Supreme Minos ruled his far-flung empire. At the head of our government is the State Council, which consists of the 10 lords appointed by the Supreme Minos. Their duties and responsibilities cover every facet of our national existence, from the worship of the god Cronus, which is mandatory for all citizens, to the payment of taxes, which is not optional. Torren chuckled at his little joke. The other major ministries are the Admiralty, the Department of Trade, and the Army. With an effort, I was able to set aside the pain of my loss and concentrate on this vital information. I was even able to join in the conversation. Of course, the entire world knows about the Minoan fleet, which surpasses those of all other nations, but I was unaware that you had a significant army. Our army musters almost 50,000 highly trained men, Torren told me proudly. By Horus, that must be the greater part of your total population, I exclaimed with astonishment. All the senior officers are Minoan, but the rank and file are mercenaries. The bulk of our own population are skilled workmen and not soldiers. Now I understand. I was so fascinated by this information. And I am certain that your superb fleet of ships would be able very swiftly to transport these fighting men to wherever they are most needed. Torren listed for me the names and responsibilities of all the senior military officers. Then he discussed the strengths and weaknesses of each of these men of power. Some of them are skilled and far-sighted warriors, but too many of the others see only as far as their own purses, bellies, or crotches. However, when I tried to question Torren further about the Supreme Minos and the nature of the being behind the golden mask, he became as skittish as an unbroken colt and shied away from the subject with a brief warning. It is an offence of lese majeste, punishable by death, to discuss the person of the Supreme Minos. It is sufficient for you to know that he embodies the spirit of our nation. This time I shall take into consideration the fact that you asked that question in ignorance. But I caution you to take this warning seriously, Taita. We both lapsed into awkward silence as we rounded a rocky buttress of the mountain and came suddenly upon the accommodation that had been placed at my disposal. It was a large building, but like all the others I had seen so far, it was sombre and ugly. There were no gardens to embellish its stolid grey stonework. Instead, it was surrounded with trellised grapevines. My household servants were lined up in front of the main doors to welcome me, although their welcome was as gloomy as the walls behind them. Of course they are slaves, Torren explained offhandedly. All of them have had their tongues and vocal cords removed, so you will not be bothered by their idle chatter. Neither will I learn anything of interest or importance from them, I thought, although I did not voice my reservation. This is Bessus, your majordomo. He pointed to a sturdy rogue with a pleasant smile. He understands Egyptian, but for obvious reasons does not speak it. Ask him for whatever you need. Torren moved on briskly, leading me on a tour of my new home. The rooms were commodious but austere.
My personal effects and spare clothing had been sent up from the harbour ahead of our arrival. They had been unpacked, washed, and neatly arranged in my living area. Adjoining my bedroom was a library with 100 or more large scrolls stacked on the shelves. This is the definitive history of the Minoan Empire, a great deal of it written by me. I hope you will perhaps find it instructive, Toran explained, and then he indicated the low writing table in the centre of the room. There are inks and brushes, blank papyrus scrolls of fine quality for your exclusive use. I will be able to arrange delivery of your missives to any destination in the world. You are very kind, good Toran. I thanked him with a straight face, but I smiled inwardly and qualified his offer silently, presumably only after you have made fair copies. I understood that there was a limit to his friendship and kindness. There are 50 amphorae of good wine in the cellars, he continued. They will be replenished as soon as they are empty. Fresh fish and meat will be sent up from the harbour every morning. The two cooks are excellent. I know from personal experience. I chose them for you. We went out into the stable yard, where the head groom prostrated himself before me. I could see the fresh whip wheels across his bare back. On your feet, fellow? I hid my true feelings behind a friendly tone. Once I also had been a slave, and I remembered well enough the kiss of the lash. What is your name? I demanded of him, and with an effort he gurgled his reply. He was a cheerful little fellow, very clearly not Cretan. Waga? I repeated the sound, and he blubbered with laughter. Very well, Waga. Show me your horses. He ran ahead of me to the stables, emitting unintelligible but enthusiastic sounds through his empty gullet. There were 8 fine mounts in the small paddock behind the stables. Waga whistled them up, and they came to him at once, whickering with pleasure. He fed each one of them with a small baked corn cake from the leather pouch on his hip. If the horses trusted him, then I determined to do the same, at least until he proved me wrong. Horses usually show keen judgment. One day soon I will need to ride to Crimad on the south shore. I will need a guide to show me the road. Do you know the way? Waga nodded emphatically. Be ready, I warned him. I will give you very little notice, and we will ride hard. He grinned. It seemed that we were already reaching an accord. On the following morning, I rose before the sun and ate a hurried breakfast before I rode down the mountain to the Admiralty. I spent the entire day there, arguing and negotiating with the Vice-Admiral Herakal and his staff, all to very little avail. They offered me 8 decrepit biremes, which had clearly spent many years as trading ships and had now reached the limit of their useful life. With these, they expected me to subdue the Hyksos hordes. I was learning that the Minoans in general were a sullen and difficult people, and extremely hostile towards strangers and foreigners. The only one I had met so far who was an exception to this rule was Ambassador Toran. He was so affable and obliging that he could have been born an Egyptian. That evening I rode back to my new home, spiritually exhausted and discouraged. I hardly tasted the meal of grilled lamb that the cook had prepared for me. However, a flagon of the delicious wine that Toran had laid down in my cellars gave me the strength to persevere, and at dawn the next day I rode down the mountain to the Admiralty once more. It took all my bargaining skills and some little assistance from Toran, but by the 10th day I had finally assembled a flotilla of 6 almost new 3-deckers. The Vice-Admiral had reluctantly given me experienced Minoan officers to sail them, and hardened mercenaries, drawn from amongst the savage tribes of northern Italia, to crew them. These people called themselves Latins or Etruscans. Toran assured me that they were excellent sailors and fearsome warriors. With 120 of these savages aboard each of the triremes, I was content that we could match any ship in the Hyksos fleet. I ordered my new captains to sail around the island to the port of Crimad, where Zaras and Hui were anchored with my Sumerian biremes ready for sea. From now onwards, this would be our main base of operations, from which we could strike at the enemy, who were only 600 leagues to the south, 5 days' sailing, with favourable winds.